Many planets have atmospheres, but what is it about Earth's atmosphere that has made life on our planet possible? To find out, we have invited onto today's edition of Please Explain Dr. Joel Levine, Senior Research Scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center, and Dr. Richard C.J. Somerville, Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard. Good to be here.
Joel, can you give us the basic definition of atmosphere?
Well, an atmosphere is a gaseous envelope that's gravitationally held by a planet's gravitational attraction. In case of planet Mercury, for example, it's a very, very small planet. Its gravitational attraction is very, very weak, and there's a very, very small, tenuous atmosphere. The same thing is true of the Moon. The Moon has a very, very thin atmosphere. In the case of planet Earth, fortunately, we have an appreciable atmosphere, and it's very important not only to maintain life, but for the origin of life, because the atmosphere provided the raw materials that led to the formation of life on our planet billions of years ago.
Are most of the elements present in the atmosphere of Earth also in other planets in our solar system?
Well, it's interesting because, as you know, the composition of the Earth's atmosphere is mostly nitrogen, 78% by volume. Oxygen is about 21%. If we look at planet Mars, it's very different. Mars is 95% carbon dioxide, 3% nitrogen, 2% argon. Venus is also a carbon dioxide-rich planet, about 96% carbon dioxide with 4% nitrogen. But if we look at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, those atmospheres are mostly hydrogen, about 90%, with helium accounting for about 10%. So if we look at it in the solar system, we see a different composition of atmospheres around different planets.
Richard, why is nitrogen so important for our atmosphere? We don't breathe nitrogen, do we?
No, we don't breathe nitrogen, and it's ironic and in some ways, you might say, counterintuitive that some of the substances in our atmosphere that are present in very small quantities are very important to life on Earth. You can think of the ozone and the ozone layer, for example, that protects us from harmful radiation from the sun. But just plain old water vapor that's present in the atmosphere in significant quantities and that is capable of changing phase, so it can change from vapor water to liquid water to solid water or ice, is very important to life on Earth. And we're now learning, of course, that gases present in much smaller quantities, like carbon dioxide, which contribute to the greenhouse effect and which is changing because of human activities, are critical to climate.
And there's so much carbon dioxide, as you we heard, on Mars, which would suggest that they already have a greenhouse effect?
Oh, yes, they do. And Venus has a much more potent greenhouse effect because, as Joel Levine said, the atmosphere is largely carbon dioxide, and Venus is closer to the sun, so the sun's energy is much more intense on Venus. And when you send a space probe to Venus, which has been done, by the time it gets to the surface, it's no good anymore because Venus is hundreds of degrees in temperature, hot enough to melt ordinary metals. But on the Earth, we have a Goldilocks planet in between Mars and Venus in terms of distance from the sun, also in between in climate. So we have evolved, you might say, because conditions on Earth were favorable to it.
Joel, is there a definable boundary between the Earth's atmosphere and space?
Yes, there is. The uppermost region of the Earth's atmosphere that begins about 500 miles above the surface is called the exosphere, E-X-O-sphere. And the exosphere merges with the interplanetary medium at that point. And what's interesting, in the exosphere, atoms and molecules in the Earth's atmosphere actually escape to space. And it's a region where we lose part of the atmosphere gases in the Earth's atmosphere. And that's the boundary between the interplanetary space and the Earth's atmosphere.
And our gravity just keeps that in place? I mean, does nothing drift off?
Yes, it does drift off because the distance between gases in the atmosphere above 500 miles is very great, and the molecules of the Earth's atmosphere can actually escape the gravitational field of the Earth.
So then they would just go into space, sort of drifting little. Would they then land somewhere else?
Well, they'll end up in the interplanetary medium and become part of the interplanetary medium.
Now, we have often talked, in public school we learned why the sky is blue, but I've always wondered whether the sky on Mars or Venus would also appear to be blue.
Actually, the sky on Mars appears to be a reddish color, and the reason it appears to be a reddish color is Mars has a lot of dust blown up from the surface of the planet, and the atmosphere, Mars is a red planet because there are iron oxides on the surface, giving it a characteristic red color. Mars is called the red planet, and a lot of the dust from the surface is blown up into the atmosphere, giving Mars a pinkish-red atmosphere. Now, so it's very different than the Earth's atmosphere.
But is dust what's giving us our blue color?
What's giving our blue color is the scattering. It's called Rayleigh scattering of incoming sunlight by molecules in the atmosphere. On Mars, most of the scattering is done by dust, and that's a bigger size than molecules, and it results in a reddish color or a pinkish color in the atmosphere.
Now, Richard, you said earlier that Earth's atmosphere developed billions of years ago. Did it develop with the creation of the planet itself?
It has evolved over time, just as the rest of the Earth has evolved. There have been intricate interactions between the composition of the atmosphere and geological processes on Earth, and between the atmosphere and life itself, and that process is continuing. You know, I mentioned carbon dioxide, the gas that's of the greatest concern to us when we talk about climate change and strengthening the natural greenhouse effect and global warming. And right now, human activity has increased carbon dioxide so much that roughly one out of four molecules of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is there because of human causes. That is, it's there largely because you and I and our 6.5 billion friends and neighbors and their ancestors have put it there from burning coal and oil and natural gas, also from other processes, from deforestation, for example. So right now, what makes our time different from our grandparents' time is that we, the human species, are playing an active role. We've markedly changed the chemical composition of the atmosphere, and as we've learned, that has profound consequences for the climate.
And that one in four, none of those ones are good.
Well, carbon dioxide is a pretty innocuous gas if you think of it in small quantities. You know, it's the bubbles in champagne and soda pop and beer. It's not toxic. It's essentially colorless and odorless.
What feeds the plants?
It feeds plants, and you breathe it out, and the plants breathe it in. All that's good. What's of concern is that we have changed the natural balance. That is, we've added so much carbon dioxide to the atmosphere so rapidly that the Earth is, you might say, out of balance with its environment, and that's causing the warming that we're beginning to see and that will have profound consequences for the climate. You know, global warming is not a very good term scientifically because it's a symptom, the way a fever is a symptom of disease. But a warming of the planet by a few degrees has terribly profound consequences in terms of rising sea level and changing patterns of rainfall and many, many aspects of the climate that affect humans and also affect natural systems, ecosystems.
Well, people are largely saying climate change instead of global warming. My guests are Dr. Richard C.J. Somerville, Distinguished Professor Emeritus, Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, and author of The Forgiving Air, and Dr. Joel Levine, Senior Research Scientist, NASA Langley Research Center, and Principal Investigator at Langley's proposed Ares Mars airplane mission. We are talking about the atmosphere on today's Please Explain on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How do scientists even study changes in the atmosphere?
Well, which of us? We can both talk about that.
I'm going to start throwing out questions just to either of you because you pretty much know everything that the answers to all the things that I could ever ask.
Well, I wish I did. But scientists have been studying the atmosphere for a long time, and of course, the atmosphere is important to us because that's where the weather is, and we are very much crabs crawling along at the bottom of an ocean of air, and the weather affects many, many human activities profoundly. So much of the study of the atmosphere has been motivated by studying weather and trying to forecast weather, and today, the old tools, the barometers and thermometers and wind vanes and so on, have largely been supplemented by remote sensing, especially from satellites in space. And scientists study the atmosphere theoretically in many ways, including building computer simulations. So the study of the atmosphere is an extremely active area of science today.
Joel, maybe you can go through the different layers that make up the Earth's atmosphere.
Okay, but before I begin talking about the regions, let me point out, Leonard, that many, many years ago, when we were youngsters, Richard and I were both students in meteorology at New York University. So we go back a long time from our graduate school days.
So is this a kind of a reunion for you?
It's a kind of a reunion. Well, we see each other at meetings, but I know you originate from New York City, and that's where both Richard and I studied. So I just thought I would mention that.
Thanks for bringing us together, Leonard.
Yes, you're putting us together. That's right. The region of the atmosphere that's closest to the Earth is called the troposphere. We live in the troposphere. The troposphere contains weather, clouds. Most of the atmosphere is in the troposphere. The troposphere goes from about the surface to about 8 miles above the surface. At 8 miles, the troposphere ends, and we have a region known as the stratosphere.
Well, let me stop you right there. Is the troposphere kept in place by gravity, because we talked about the importance of gravity, or is it also kept in place by the fact that there are these other layers on top of it?
It's held in place because of gravity. The whole atmosphere is gravitationally bound. And what determines the different regions in the atmosphere is how temperature varies within the atmosphere. In the region known as the troposphere, temperature decreases with altitude.
Are the oceans included in that?
The oceans are a different system of the Earth system.
Mm-hmm.
And the oceans are not part of the atmosphere.
But the troposphere is where, as you said, all the weather patterns occur.
And where we live. We live in the troposphere.
And the other layers have nothing to do with weather patterns, the high-pressure systems, the storms, the winds, et cetera, et cetera?
Basically, the troposphere is the region where all weather phenomena takes place. And most of the mass of the atmosphere is in the troposphere. Above the troposphere, at about 8 miles above the surface, the temperature begins to increase. And it begins to increase in the stratosphere because there is a gas called ozone, chemical symbol O subscript 3, which is a form of oxygen. Ozone has a unique property. Ozone can absorb biologically lethal radiation called ultraviolet radiation the sun gives off. And the ozone in the Earth's atmosphere protects us and protects vegetation and all forms of life from this deadly ultraviolet radiation.
Let's bring Richard in here, because most people know little about the ozone other than the fact that there was a hole in the ozone layer. Was that a unique thing that happened some years ago?
Well, it really was unique in the sense that for a long time the ozone layer has been there, and as Joel says, it has protected us and other living things from radiation from the sun in the ultraviolet part of the solar spectrum that without the ozone layer can be lethal. It can cause skin cancer and many other bad things.
How can a hole develop in the middle of a layer?
Well, that's a kind of metaphor. Ozone is a rare gas, and the ozone layer, which, as Joel said, is in the stratosphere, in the lower stratosphere, actually, is the region where ozone is, you might say, slightly less rare than it is elsewhere. It's never very plentiful, but the ozone layer is a figure of speech, meaning the area of the lower stratosphere where there's more ozone than there is either above it or below it. And the hole is, again, a kind of journalistic metaphor for the fact that man-made chemicals, chlorofluorocarbons is the chemical term for many of them, Freon is the DuPont trade name that many of us know them by, man-made chemicals were released into the atmosphere inadvertently and made their way into the stratosphere, And through a process that for decades was unsuspected, they led to the destruction of ozone.
But it's interesting that it's over Antarctica. It's not over the United States, where many of those fluorocarbons and such were released.
That's right. But over time, the winds spread them around, and it just so happens that the conditions in Antarctica are more favorable to the destruction of ozone. For example, it involves very cold temperatures. There has been loss of ozone in other parts of the world, but it was most dramatic in Antarctica, and so the term ozone hole has crept into common usage. This is actually, Leonard, a great scientific triumph and in many ways a paradigm that we'd like to see repeated in the much more difficult and vexing problem of dealing with global warming or climate change, because in a very short period of time, from initial basic science discoveries in the 1970s through the discovery of the ozone hole in the early 1980s, on to signing international treaties, so the Montreal Protocol is the most famous one, that banned the production of the offending chemicals, it's a success story. Science and politics and business and public opinion all came together, and as a result, the ozone layer, as best as we understand it, is on track to heal slowly. It will take decades. It may be late in the current century before it has reached its pristine former condition. But we averted a possible tragedy by this remarkable combination of science, governments, people, and business singing from the same page.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will deal with the last of these, the ionosphere, which is particularly important to people like me because I'm in radio. And we will be taking listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And my guests are Dr. Richard C.J. Somerville, Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, the University of California, San Diego, author of The Forgiving Air, Understanding Environmental Change, which is published by the American Meteorological Society. Also, Dr. Joel Levine, Senior Research Scientist at NASA Langley Research Center and Principal Investigator at Langley's proposed Ares-Mars airplane mission. Maybe we'll be able to find out a little more about that as well. Again, our number 212-433-9692. We'll be back right after this. And we're back with our discussion on Please Explain of the Atmosphere with Drs. Joel Levine and Dr. Richard C.J. Somerville. And we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 in just a moment. But we can't leave out the ionosphere. The ionosphere is what makes radio transmission possible, isn't it? How does that work?
Joel, you want to take that?
Okay, I'll try, Richard. The sun gives off a lot of radiation. Not only the light that we see, which is visible radiation, and heat that we receive that warms up the planet, but the sun gives off a lot of shortwave radiation called ultraviolet radiation and X radiation. And when this radiation interacts with the gases in the atmosphere, it causes a process known as ionization, where it takes a molecule, strips away one electron or two electrons. That leaves a positively charged fragment of the molecule called an ion, I-O-N, and several, one or more electrons. Now, these electrons are very important in shortwave radio communication because they act as a mirror and reflect radio signals that emanate from the Earth's surface, from ham radio operators, and reflect it back. And when they reflect it back to the Earth, they can cover great distances.
Well, at night, they can cover more distances than during the day. Why is that?
Because the atmosphere, the production of ions, maximizes at that time, and we have more reflectivity in the atmosphere.
Doesn't the aurora borealis occur in the ionosphere? What happens to cause the aurora borealis?
Aurora borealis is caused when particles, not radiation, but particles interact with the Earth's atmosphere. Particles from the sun get in to the Earth's atmosphere through magnetic lines of force. They interact with the gases in the atmosphere, and put it in a higher energy state, and the molecules in the atmosphere don't want to remain in the higher energy state. They fall back to a lower energy state and give off visible radiation, and that's what we call the aurora borealis.
Well, I would imagine there's a certain logic to these three separate layers. Why would the ionosphere, this electrically charged layer, be at the top? I mean, is there any reason? Is it one of the things that helps life exist on Earth?
It's at the top, Leonard, because the radiation from the sun that causes the ionosphere in the first place, it's more intense at the upper atmosphere as it enters the Earth's atmosphere. Then as the radiation goes through the atmosphere, a lot of it is absorbed, causing ionization, forming ions and forming electrons.
Leonard, it's ironic, but you might say that for the same kinds of reasons that the aurora and the ionosphere are high up, we're down low because, you know, the pressure, which is essentially the weight of the atmosphere above us, is greatest at the surface. And for the same reason, if you were in a high-flying airplane and the cabin lost pressure, it would have to suddenly be repressurized by the machinery on the plane, or you'd die. We require a certain amount of oxygen to breathe, and we can't survive unassisted at high altitudes. That's why people climbing Mount Everest take oxygen with them. We're creatures of the lower atmosphere, and we depend on the abundance of the atmosphere that's much greater at the surface. As we said earlier on, nearly all of the atmosphere is in the troposphere, the lowest 8 or 10 miles or so, and these phenomena that we've been talking about, like the ozone layer and the ionosphere and the aurora, are far above that, where the atmosphere is actually very sparse, where there's much more space between the molecules and where most of the air is far, far below you.
Where do commercial jets fly?
Commercial jets tend to fly right about in the boundary between the troposphere and the stratosphere. It's a balance between how much lift they have and how much air they have to push out of the way, you might say. And, of course, specialized planes, fighter jets, for example, can fly higher than that. But it's always a balance. But except for people temporarily in high-flying airplanes or spacecraft, all of the human race is in the troposphere.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. Hi, Rhea from Bayshore. You're on the air.
Hello. It's a fascinating conversation. I'm an environmental scientist, and I work with air quality and vehicle emissions. And my question to the scientists is, ozone is a federally regulated pollutant under the EPA National Air Quality Standards. What makes ozone a pollutant adjacent to the Earth's surface? What keeps it from migrating to the upper atmosphere? And are there two different types of ozone?
That's a wonderful question, and I think we can probably both speak to it. I'll just start out by saying that chemically it's the very same thing. It's the molecule O3. That's a molecule comprised of three atoms of oxygen. We talk about good ozone and bad ozone. The good ozone is in the stratosphere where the ozone layer is. It's what protects us from ultraviolet radiation, and without it, life on Earth as we know it wouldn't have developed. Bad ozone is part of air pollution, as you know, and bad ozone, which occurs as a component of smog and is found in polluted areas at the surface, near the surface, in polluted city atmospheres, for example, and it has harmful effects on everything from crops to the paint on your car. So it's the same chemical, it's the same three atoms in a molecule form of oxygen created by different processes. And where it is depends on whether it's good or bad.
And you want to add anything to that, Joel?
No, I think Richard did an excellent job. That close to the ground, ozone is an irritant and a pollutant. It's bad for humans. It's bad for trees. It's bad for agricultural crops. But the same ozone in the stratosphere is very beneficial to maintaining life on our planet. And about 90% of the ozone is in the stratosphere, the lower atmosphere, the lower stratosphere, as Richard said, and only a small amount is near the surface in the troposphere.
Thank you for calling us, Rhea.
Well, what really keeps it moving from, you know, the ozone on the surface from going up where we need it?
Well, ozone is not a constant thing. You know, it gets produced and destroyed, and the chemical processes that do that are active in these two areas primarily. So the ozone near the surface rarely influences the high atmosphere and vice versa.
Thank you for calling. Bill in Dix Hill left a question on our show page. He says, there are a group of scientists that dispute the idea that the rise in temperature is due to increased CO2. Their conjecture is a strong correlation between solar flares and a rise in temperature. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I have a strong opinion on that, Leonard, and I'd like to make sure your listeners get it. There's an overwhelming scientific consensus that the recent warming in, say, the last 4 or 5 decades has been due overwhelmingly to human activities, in particular through human production of greenhouse gases. The alternative explanations, such as solar activity, have been tested time and time again. They fail quantitatively. Does the sun matter? Yes, it does. But we can put numbers on these things. There's a lot of science that's been done, and you can never say, science doesn't give you absolute certainty. You can never say that something cannot possibly be erroneous. But there's a degree of scientific consensus, of overwhelming agreement in the expert research community that students of science, historians of science, for example, have studied and have said it's rare to find that. You can always find outliers. You can find retrovirus experts who don't think that HIV causes AIDS. But in this case, a tiny number of very noisy contrarian scientists dispute the mainstream consensus. Their claims have been examined time and time again, and it's overwhelmingly likely that they are incorrect.
And you want to add anything to that, Joel?
Yeah, I agree 100% with what Richard just stated. And let me point out for your listeners that the consensus that global warming is due to carbon dioxide primarily and the buildup of carbon dioxide is due to human activities is a major conclusion of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. The IPCC consists of several hundred scientists from over 100 countries working for almost 2 decades using computer models, using observations. It's not the consensus of 1 or 2 scientists or even scientists in one country. This is an international panel of the top climate scientists on planet Earth. They issue reports every few years, and the last one was issued in 2007. And the conclusion is there is unambiguous evidence that human activities are responsible for the buildup of carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide buildup in the atmosphere is responsible for global warming.
And Richard, you were the author of the IPCC's 2007 report.
I am one of the authors. I'm a coordinating lead author. That means a chapter head. But as Joel says, this is an international a group of scientists. Their work has been reviewed extensively. It's been endorsed by all the leading scientific societies. And I urge your listeners to go directly to the IPCC. The website is www.ipcc.ch, where all of the reports are available for free downloads.
Now, we're going to hit some things very quickly. One listener was concerned that when we send rockets out of Earth's atmosphere, that we're destroying the various layers of our atmosphere.
Joel, go for it.
Yes. Well, let me say I work for NASA. NASA spent a considerable time and effort to see the impact of rocket exhausts on the Earth's atmosphere, the impact of rocket exhausts on ozone, and the conclusion is there is no impact at all. The rocket launch of rockets is so few and far in between, the impact on the atmosphere is negligible.
Veda from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is to your panel. When you have gas planets like Jupiter, how do you decide where the planet ends and where the atmosphere starts?
That's a very, very good question. And we have no evidence that in the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, that there is in fact even a surface beneath the very, very thick atmosphere. So we tried to send radar echoes off Jupiter. We have not gotten a return. We have no evidence that there is a solid surface below the very massive and thick atmospheres on Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Thank you for your call. Elizabeth from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question is, what kind of damage are we causing by the plane's high temperature exhaust? Obviously, we have millions of planes in the air at any time. What is the consensus on that issue?
Well, first of all, the number of planes in the air is in the thousands rather than in the millions. And it's true that if you stand behind a plane, the exhaust will burn you. But the atmosphere is vast, and the number of planes is small. And so, in fact, all of human activities that are producing heat, including, for example, heating millions of buildings, is not important quantitatively compared to the heating that we're doing by adding to the greenhouse effect by increasing the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. This question and the previous one are good examples of the importance of numbers to science. Science is quantitative, and it's true that a rocket does some local disturbance to the part of the atmosphere it's in. It's true that an airplane heats the atmosphere from its exhaust. But quantitatively, when you do the numbers, when you measure things and compare magnitudes, these are not important.
Jane from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, considering the amount of damage we have done to our Earth already, is it... do you think we should be going into to other planets? Do we know what kind of damage we're doing to the Moon or to Mars? It scares me.
And Joel, you're about to embark on a trip to the Mars, aren't you?
We're hoping to fly the first airplane outside of Earth. We're hoping to fly a robotic airplane called Ares, A-R-E-S. Through the atmosphere of Mars to study its chemical composition, to study its winds, to study meteorology, and learn more about it.
What I'm hearing from the caller is that we've messed up this situation. Should we be going out there and messing up other places?
Good. That's a very good question. And let me say that by studying the planets, by sending robotic missions to Venus, sending robotic missions to Mars and the other planets, we've learned a great deal about planet Earth. Richard mentioned the ozone depletion problem and chlorofluorocarbons and the role that chlorine has in destroying ozone on Earth. Well, we learned about that because we studied the chemistry of the atmosphere of Venus, where there are chlorine compounds, and we studied the chlorine problem, natural chlorine on Venus, and it gave us a good basis to learn about ozone destruction.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately, but I do want people to know that we've added a link to the IPCC's reports on our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to Dr. Joel Levine and Dr. Richard C.J. Somerville for participating in today's Please Explain, which we've been talking about the atmosphere. It's been great.
Thank you, Leonard. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Leonard.